Japanese poet, monk, wandered through Japan, spreading, embodying wisdom. So this is what he says. When my house burned down, I gained an unobstructed view of the moonlit sky. When my house burned down, I gained an unobstructed view of the moonlit sky. So over the last months, I've been offering a series of talks on the paramis, the 10 perfections, or forces for transformation. And actually, I haven't offered the talks serially. I was inspired when I was sitting at the Forest Refuge 2 or 3 years ago, and one of the teachers, Rebecca Bradshaw, kind of just spoke about the parami that was most present and juiciest, and so that's what I've been doing. These paramis, parami is a Pali word. It's the ancient language that the Buddhist discourses or the suttas were first recorded in. And it literally is translated as the other shore. And these perfections of mind and heart can be understood both as a means to reach the other shore, which is a metaphor for awakening, for full presence, and as an expression of the qualities of one who has done so. And these qualities of mind and heart are part of what we cultivate and what the Buddha to be is reputed to have cultivated over many, many lifetimes in various forms before waking up under the Bodhi tree one night almost 2,600 years ago in Bodh Gaya in what is now India. So they are generosity, ethical virtue or integrity, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, determination, truthfulness, loving friendliness, and equanimity. And tonight I want to talk about the third parami, the third force of transformation, and that is renunciation or restraint. The literal translation of the Pali word for renunciation, nakama, is freedom from sensual lust, or freedom from sense greed, from being enslaved by grasping, by all the delights or all the experiences that come to us through the senses. Last week, I spoke about the second parami, that of virtue or integrity. And there was a question after the talk and after we sat together for a few moments. I don't think the person's here tonight, but there was a question about kind of the de-emphasis on sila or virtue in Western Buddhism, sometimes in the way that it's taught and the way that it's practiced. You know, because most of us want to learn and did learn bhavana, mental development, meditation, initially, and weren't necessarily introduced to virtue and to renunciation in kind of the order that the teachings indicate that the Buddha approached it. And this is neither right nor wrong, it's just sometimes instructive to look at how our own cultural predispositions or biases might cause us to overlook or ignore certain critical aspects of the teaching. Renunciation, you know, both the understanding of renunciation and the practice can vary quite considerably, depending on the tradition or the lineage and whether it's East or West. Someone, I don't remember who, once referred to sometimes the way that Buddhism is practiced in the West, which sometimes can seem to have an overemphasis on kind of the individual development of meditation and maybe less of a focus on interdependence and community and compassion as a verb in terms of acting. Although we all discover that, you know, the practice is incomplete or not grounded if it does not include generosity and ethics and restraint and certainly wisdom and compassion. So sometimes it's been referred to as the upper middle way, you know, the approach to practicing Buddhism in the West. And, you know, in renunciation and practicing it, what we're really relinquishing is our attachment to what pleases and delights our senses. I mean, that's certainly a part of it, of noticing where there's what Pema Chodron talks about as shempa or a hook, so that we're hooked by a particular sight or sound or thought, and then kind of off and running and lost in our fantasies about what it is or what it might be or how this will affect me or how it will be great for someone else. That tendency or quality of the mind to run away, given any stimulus, the mind having a mind of its own. And, you know, we're born into these human minds and bodies and hearts, and there are certain realities or ways that we're connected and, you know, we're part of nature. And again, it's not wrong or bad. What the practice and the teachings of the Buddha offer are ways to become more conscious, to become more aware of what hooks us. And certainly, sense desire or sense greed is a major form of craving and clinging. It causes us to kind of forget where we are and who we are and what we're doing. So, you know, renunciation and restraint can be understood as a movement towards greater simplicity and contentment. Contentment with what we receive or what we are given, what we already have, such as considering the effects of consumption, considering the effects of what we really need in our lives, you know, what is necessary. So there's this aspect of renunciation where, you know, we may think about it, well, can have all these possessions or all these views and opinions or all these experiences as long as I'm not attached to them. And certainly that's an aspect of renunciation, you know, and letting go is observing where there is attachment, where there's an identification, and exploring the process of letting go. And of course, it's always interesting to look and play with, you know, the mind's, I'm not really attached to this latest tech device, or I'm not really attached to, you know, my favorite program, or my favorite this, or my favorite that, or I'm not really attached. And see, well, is that really true? Sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. But in addition to looking at attachment and clinging, really this practice of renunciation does point us towards simplicity and contentment, looking at ways that we can invite a greater simplicity into our lives. And last week, and actually in many Dharma talks, I speak about the Buddha's teaching on happiness and how what he offered and what he pointed to in describing the path was this movement from a particular kind of happiness, namely the happiness that comes from sensual delight. And this doesn't mean that, you know, we're going to secrete ourselves or wall ourselves into a cave or not enjoy or appreciate what we see or what we hear or a well-phrased sentence or line that we read. But what the Buddha talked about is how that happiness of the senses is limited. It's not sufficient. And that what we can explore or discover as we practice is a happiness that comes from virtue, from ethics, from the bliss of blamelessness, when our conduct doesn't hurt ourselves and doesn't hurt others. The happiness that comes from restraint, from renunciation, from not kind of chasing what we like and what we want. The happiness that comes from concentration, from the meditative practices of concentration and insight, and then the greatest happiness of the unconditioned, of a liberating wisdom. And of course, to really walk and follow this path, to taste these various happinesses, it's necessary to practice a certain amount of restraint. You know, even we see that all the time when we sit. If our intention is to be with the sensations of breathing and we observe or we notice that we're in the middle of a fantasy, there's a, you know, there's a choice there, once there's a mindfulness that's present, of continuing with the fantasy or finding ourselves jumping to another one or kind of just letting papancha or this running around play out, or to return, to start over with being with the sensations of breathing. So from the Dhammapada, which are some of the most accessible teachings of the Buddha, we have this. It is wisdom that enables letting go of a lesser happiness in pursuit of a happiness which is greater. It is wisdom that enables letting go of a lesser happiness in pursuit of a happiness which is greater. And of course, we have to see for ourselves. We have to see for ourselves what agitates, disturbs, unsettles the mind and the heart, and what tends to calm it and settle it, and where there's a sense of greater ease and less struggle. And it's very often connected. Of course, it's connected with whether there is clinging and attachment. So this is how Ajahn Chah put it, one of the forest Thai masters who's been so influential in those who are practicing and teaching in the West. If you let go a little, you will have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you will have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will have complete peace. So renunciation, when practiced, is not an austere or puritanical denial stemming from fear or a prune-faced asceticism, which sometimes it can be. Or we might observe that it appears to be that way in others. But monastics, for some of you who have sat with monastics or perhaps visited various monasteries, you may have noticed that some of the most relaxed and happiest and serene persons you could ever hope to meet are monastics who basically live, you know, with the four requisites, with the basics. Now, we as householders have more of an expanded field of requisites. And there's always the possibility of simplifying. Because this practice of letting go, whether a little, a lot, or completely, really shows us starkly the reality of the second noble truth, that suffering or unease, disturbance, dukkha, is caused by attachment and clinging. And this is how Joseph Goldstein put it. For many people, the word renunciation conjures up images of hermits in caves, or unbearable ascetic disciplines. Or we might consider resignation as something that is probably good for us, but definitely burdensome. It is said that St. Augustine offered up this prayer, "Dear God, make me chaste, but not yet." But it is possible to understand renunciation in a way that resonates more deeply within us. We can begin to see that addiction is the burden, and that not buying into it is the freedom. Imagine yourself watching television with endless commercials and desiring everything you see. That would be a state of tremendous suffering compared with the peace of just letting them all pass by. To let go of the commercials on TV is easy. Letting go of the endless commercials in our mind is more difficult. So, and we're surrounded by an abundance of choice, you know, with 50 different kinds of crackers on the grocery shelves of the store, or 50 different kinds of breakfast cereal, or 5 different kinds of yogurt, or who knows how many different kinds of office chairs, or, I mean, just expand it indefinitely or exponentially. How would it feel to be guided by simplicity, by this intention for simplicity and contentment? The sense that in each moment we truly have all that we need. I love this practice that Sharon Salzberg describes, one that she has reflected on and offered, is that she will ask herself, you know, if she notices agitation or kind of any hint of the mind being out of sync with what's present currently, what do I truly need to be happy? What do I truly need to be happy? Even when we're in the middle of deep anxiety or fear or any other difficult emotion or experience, or receiving news that we don't really want to hear, if we can pause and stop for just a moment and really ask ourselves, what do we really need in this moment to be happy? It can point us towards looking right now, this moment, for what is happiness and what is not happiness. You know, it's certainly not in what we own or possess, and it's certainly not in all the ways our egos are are pumped up or gratified, although certainly that can be a delicious momentary happiness, and we can enjoy that when it happens, knowing that it comes and goes, and that it isn't really the basis for any lasting or fundamental happiness. So happiness truly results from embodying wisdom and compassion. So now I want to talk a little about the conditions that give rise to renunciation, to the understanding and the inclusion, the living of renunciation. And certainly a major aspect of this is realizing that greed or desire is insatiable. Wanting or grasping is suffering. And we can really notice not only its arising, but also its dissolving and its disappearing. I had a really stark lesson in that when I was 10 years old. And I asked my mother, you know, who was a single mom, oldest of three children, and I wanted this 10-speed Schwinn bicycle, lime green bicycle, desperately. And the wish, the desire for that bicycle was so, so intense. And, you know, my mother bought it for me and gave it to me for that Christmas present. And the man who sold it to her was actually a Japanese-American who was of a generation where, as a younger man, he had been in the relocation camps that the Japanese were, or Japanese Americans were interned in during World War II. And he talked to me about just how precious, or what it had, in a sense, cost my mother, not only financially, but just what was involved in this bicycle. And at the time, I thought he was rather mean. I didn't want to hear it. And I didn't want to really reflect on that. And I enjoyed the bicycle and rode it, but it really kind of pointed out to me in a very visceral way that the happiness, the pleasure, the satisfaction that I thought would come from owning and using this bicycle just wasn't there. And of course, we all have these moments where we notice that what we've most been desiring doesn't last. So this is a tale about a Hasidic rabbi that points to that as well. Noticing the hello and the goodbye of every desire or every want that we have, that nothing lasts, no experience that is conditioned, is satisfying in that way. In the last century, an affluent tourist went to visit a Polish rabbi, renowned for the depth of his learning and compassion. Arriving at the impoverished village where the rabbi made his home, he was astonished to discover the rabbi living in a simple room with only a few books and the most basic furniture. "Rabbi, where is all your furniture, your library, your diplomas?" he asked. "Where are yours?" answered the rabbi. "Mine? But I am only a visitor here." "So am I," replied the rabbi. So in addition to really noticing the insatiability of sense desire, sense want, sense greed, we can observe whether and when we have a wise relationship with material goods, looking at ways that it might be possible to consume less, to use less, to own less, and also to practice what's called guarding the sense doors. And that's really noticing that when we look, when we see particularly, how quickly our eyes are drawn out. And, you know, if we're looking in a store window, it's, oh, that sweater is great. I wonder if they have it in another color. That would look really good on me. Or, oh, I know, that would look great on my sister or my friend. You know, maybe I can't buy it now, but maybe I can buy it later this month. So that tendency to rush out. So mindfulness, of course, is what allows us and teaches us and offers us the freedom of guarding the sense doors so that there's a pause, there's that wedge of considering, well, what direction do I really want this to head? Want to become lost in wanting and craving, or maybe redirect this in another way? And I want to emphasize before closing that it's really important to relate to the practices of renunciation and simplicity and contentment from a perspective and a place of love and kindness rather than aversion. Because aversion or resistance just causes us to become more deeply mired in aversion. Aversion begats aversion, basically. So the kind, loving, gentle patience of watching and seeing and asking, does this lead to a greater happiness or not? You know, is this the time and the place? Is this appropriate? Do I really need this? And of course, just to mention that the ultimate renunciation is seeing through any fixed notion or idea of self, giving up the ways that we identify. And how do we see this? You know, when the mind is scattered and running in so many different directions, so really important to let ourselves practice through the formal meditation as well as mindfulness in our lives. Coming back, really asking, what do I need to be happy in this moment? What do I really need? With gentleness, with kindness, with compassion, with love, always, always with love. So let's take a few moments to sit. And if you wish, perhaps reflecting on what your relationship to restraint or renunciation is. Is there a sense of aversion about it? Is there a sense of seeing the value in it? Is there a direct experience with seeing the benefit? Again, no judging or comparing or criticizing, but rather just, well, what is this? What is my relationship to this force of transformation that is renunciation?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.